So welcome back, and welcome to Terry Townsend, who is here as a person who can explain Senate Bill 128 to us. And tonight's topic is death with dignity, and we're going to cover it from two angles, from the Buddhist perspective. What does that mean? What does it say about it in the traditional teachings? And then Terry will talk about the contemporary issues involved and what the Senate bill consists of. And I think it's important to look at this because hopefully it will be something we'll be voting on in the next election. You know, hopefully. It needs to clear, from my understanding, a couple more hurdles. But what is the Buddhist perspective on it? And so it's not often that a Dharma talk is on impending legislation, so this is a little different tonight. I wanted to talk about it because it's a subject I have certainly wrestled with for many years. Not me personally, just philosophically, and being with people who are at end of life and how to deal with that. And as a lot of you know, this last February was very challenging for me in that regards. My stepson-in-law had stage 4 lung cancer, and beginning of February was told he had weeks, if not days, left to live. And so I was up there with my stepdaughter in Nevada City as we worked with him and did what we could. And he developed what's called terminal agitation. He is he was career Marine, and he was reliving war experiences. And this was his end of life experience, and it was pretty painful watching. In fact, Rebecca had promised him he would die at home, but he became so agitated and so convinced he was in a war theater, we had to call an ambulance and take him to hospice of the foothills up in Nevada City. And then we stayed there with him and until he died, and he did not die easily at all. When he died, the day he died, my mother called me, said she wasn't feeling good. I went down. They said she had about a week left to live. Okay. And this was rather sudden, so I was with her, giving her the same morphine that I've been giving Ben for a week. And the only day I left was to go to Ben's funeral, and that's the day she died. So it was a very emotional month of February, I can tell you, and this topic certainly came up for me, especially with Ben. My mother wouldn't have been a candidate. Ben might have been, and it might have made his passing a little bit easier. So in Buddhism, one of the three topics that the Buddha often said that we should reflect on, well, the first ones are first anapanasati, which is mindfulness of breathing, basis for our meditation practice. The second is metta, boundless friendliness for all sentient beings. And the third is maranasati, which is mindfulness of death. And it's not often talked about in sanghas, frankly, because most people don't want to talk about death, even though each one of us is going to die. And rarely do any of us believe it. It's going to happen to someone else, but it's not going to happen to me. And so that is why maranasati is a reflection that the Buddha said we should consider, he said, with every in-breath and with every out-breath. In the Year to Live group, this is the third year I'm facilitating it. We have three objectives with it, and that is to create a joy in living, absolute gratitude for this life that we have, accept that our life is finite and that we will die, and to die a good death. And hopefully that will happen for all of us. I'm asked frequently in this class, what is the Buddha's take on death with dignity? and frankly, I didn't know. When I was in chaplaincy, we had a textbook, and those of you who had gone through chaplaincy recognize it, Peter Harvey's Introduction to Buddhist Ethics. And that was pretty much all I knew about it. I'm in a lay ordination program, and I had to write a paper, a chaplaincy paper, on a subject. So I chose this. So this is pretty much what I'm talking about tonight. The guiding principle for Buddhists regarding death is the first precept. Everybody know what the first precept is? I will not harm or kill living beings. And I can't remember the Pali word right now, but anyway, it means living things that breathe, that take in a breath. I will not harm or kill them. And so this is the basis that we start at. Now, the Buddha, which I'm beginning to find out with a lot of studies, said a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And he identified the particular situation he was at. Very similar to what we do with the precepts, and especially the example I like to give is the fourth precept, which is, I will refrain from lying. So does that mean you go up to every person you know the truth about and tell them the truth? Does that mean that's always what takes place? I don't think so. As Tony Bernard loves to give as his classic example, the German family hiding Anne Frank in the attic, and the Nazis come and they say, is there a Jewish girl in this house? Are you going to tell them the truth? No. So the precepts are situational as far as I'm concerned. They are a guiding principle, but they can be situational. Anyway, Peter Harvey in his book, An Introduction to Buddhist Ethics, says that there's two types of euthanasia, and euthanasia is actually very difficult to translate from Pali. There is no such word. They use the phrase taking the knife. And so sometimes that's they translate it as euthanasia. But active euthanasia is intentionally hastening death by a deliberate positive act, such as giving a lethal injection. That's active euthanasia. Passive euthanasia is intentionally causing death by a deliberate omission, such as withdrawing food, including intravenously administering nourishment, or withholding medical treatment. And then he breaks it down into volitional actions. Involuntary euthanasia would be carried out against the wishes of the patient. It would be murder. Voluntary euthanasia occurs when a patient requests the action. Pre-voluntary euthanasia could be defined as a living will, and a lot of us have living wills. And then non-voluntary euthanasia is where a patient is not in a position to make the decision because being in a coma, Alzheimer's disease, or dementia, and that was the state my mother was in. She was in horrific pain and cried every time she was turned, but she had dementia. And believe me, it was tempting to overdose her on morphine, to be quite honest, as I saw her suffering. So according to Peter Harvey, to kill a person deliberately, even if she or he requests the action, is an act that falls under the category of murder. It is considered a complete disregard of the first precept. So that's Orthodox Buddhism. It's also a reason for a monk or nun to be dismissed from the Sangha. When I was doing this paper, Aya Santachita was staying with me, and we were taking a walk, and I decided to ask her about this. And I said, I'm doing this paper, and I'm looking at euthanasia from a Buddhist point of view. And she said, I can't even discuss it with you. When I'm in robes, it's not possible. So that's how seriously monastics and very Orthodox Buddhists take it. The other concern is the question of karma. So the thinking is that a person who has karmic residue, it has to be played out And if it's not played out in the dying process, the next life, you will have to deal with it then, again, in another lifetime. Again, this is the Orthodox way of looking at it. There were approximately 60 examples of euthanasia in the Pali Canon, where monks who kind of acted like doctors administered some sort of medicine which caused people to die as an act of compassion near the end of life. It didn't seem to be a problem till monks started really taking that 32 body part reflection very seriously and started killing themselves. Then the Buddha got really upset. And he said, no one is to incite or take a life, no matter what. So he expanded the definition of the precept to include incitement to death. Should any monk intentionally deprive a human being of life or look about for a knife bringer or eulogize death or incite anyone to death, saying, my good man, what have you of this evil, difficult life? Death would be better for you than life. Or who should deliberately and purposely in various ways eulogize death or incite to death? He is also one who's defeated. He is not in communion with the religious life. Yet, all of that, and there's three examples of people who were terminally ill, they were monks, who took the knife. And the Buddha didn't have a problem with it. So I'm going to tell you about the three examples. The first is Vikali. It's from the Vikali Sutta. And this particular monk had a terminal illness of some kind. And he told the other monks he intended to use the knife. He couldn't take the pain anymore. And the Buddha cogitated on this and then said he's very well along the path. He is close to liberation. And he actually said, do not be afraid, Vikali, do not be afraid. Your death will not be a bad one. Your demise will not be a bad one. And after Vikali receives this message from the Buddha, he uses the knife as planned. And the Buddha even leads his group of monks to a place where they could view the corpse of Vikali. And he says, this monk has achieved nibbana. So there's one exception. And so it was clear that Vikali's decision to kill himself with the motivation of ending unnecessary pain neither brought reproach from the Buddha, nor did it interfere with his personal liberation. Didn't interfere with his karma. The next one is the Chana Sutta. And the monk Chana is suffering intensely due to illness. And he also is about to die. He wants to end the pain. The description of his pain is just, you know, can't help but feel, boy, this guy was going through it. And he keeps saying, I'm not bearing up. I am not bearing up. I am not getting well. I will not get well. Strong, painful feelings are increasing in me, not subsiding, and their increase, not their subsiding, is to be discerned. The other monks are concerned that he might have broken a precept, and so he shouldn't do this. Again, the karmic concern. And the Buddha said, no, he didn't. He did not break any precepts, and he used the knife blamelessly. And so it was almost that Chana's suicide appears to be something of a non-issue in this case. It was considered by the Buddha to be an acceptable course of action. And then the final one, which is in the Pali Canon, is the monk Gaudika. And he also suffered from a serious illness. And he was going back and forth into this liberated free state. And he didn't want to die when he wasn't in the liberated free state. And so he took the knife, and he was also, it was found fine. So It seems that if somebody, the Buddha excused this and understood it, if somebody was close to liberation, if they had the right mind state. And death is supposed to be a very karmic, important time. It's a time of great concentration if your mind is settled and stable, which I'll go into in a minute. So there is a little bit of a problem in the Pali Canon regarding euthanasia, because of people who were determined by the Buddha to be enlightened. It was okay. They were without greed, hatred, or delusion. So I looked up another paper by Professor Damien Keown, and he says, the case of Chana proves the strongest evidence of the three that Buddhism condones euthanasia under certain conditions. You know, when the Buddha said that Chana was without desire, I question that because he desired to die. He had the desire to be done with this, you know, pain that he was experiencing. So there is, I found no answer to that, but that was a question I had. So in Buddhism, is life to be preserved at all costs? No, it's not. In fact, Buddhaghosa, who is the great commentarian who synthesized the Buddha's teachings into the path of purification, said, if one who is sick ceases to take food with the intention of dying when medicine and nursing care are at hand, he commits a minor offense. But in the case of a patient who has suffered a long time with a serious illness, the nursing monks may become weary and turn away in despair, thinking, we cannot cure him of this illness. Here it is legitimate to decline food and medical care if the patient sees that monks are worn out and his life cannot be prolonged. So the contrast in Buddhaghosa's discussion seems to be the person who rejects medical care with the express purpose of ending his life, and the person who resigns to the inevitability of death after treatment has failed. And there's a big difference there. So Buddhism does not recognize a moral obligation to preserve life at all cost. It doesn't see any point in preserving life beyond its natural span. And I know this is a discussion that's going on in the medical community now. You know, we can keep people going for quite a while, but what's the quality of life of so many people? It seems that in a lot of medical ethos, death itself is a failure. And that's a problem, because death is a natural fact for all of us. Another consideration for Buddhists is the importance of the state of mind at death. As I mentioned, the karmic factors that come into play. And what is really important is taking care of forgiveness, taking care of issues that you had, clearing the karmic decks, so to speak. Not an easy thing to do, and this is also what Maranasati is about, is looking at those things that are festering, that you are in denial about, and really liberating your own mind. In fact, when a Buddhist a person who practices is dying, you should be reminding them, and actually I think this is for anybody, reminding them of all the good they have done in their life. Remind them of the people they've affected, the compassionate acts that they've offered, and don't go into negative things. Be positive. It's even encouraged that you not cry. Not show any kind of sadness. Let them go with joy and happiness. This is again what Maranasati hopefully develops, so that this state of mind will be in accord with the person who's dying. In Theravada Buddhism, it's pretty, the orthodox view is a person fairly soon after death migrates, or whatever it's called, has rebirth almost instantly. In Mahayana Buddhism, it's 49 days approximately. I'm taking the Mahayana one, and I'm sitting with my mother's ashes and reciting metta every day for 49 days. I don't know if it does any good for her, but it certainly does a lot of good for me. And then finally, pain-relieving opiates and practicing compassion. Compassion is so important. So, of course, pain-relieving opiates are prescribed. But then the mind is not clear. Then again, it's very important that we've practiced beforehand, so that habitual way of being is what is beneath the surface, even if you don't see it. If you don't practice, it's going to be very difficult at the end to gather yourself together, especially if you're taking opiates and pain-relieving drugs. So, extending life, because Buddhism does not view death as a negative experience, it doesn't generally support the use of heroic intentions that only prolong the physical life of a person with no quality. So the conclusions I came to after doing this paper, and this is an extremely short version of a 20-page paper, the guiding principle for Buddhist practitioners is the first precept. This would appear on the surface to deny death with dignity legislation that Terry's going to talk about as an option for terminally ill patients. This is active euthanasia. There seems to be exceptions. If the dying person is liberated in mind, is free of hatred, greed, hatred, and delusion, close to a liberated state, euthanasia appeared to be acceptable in those three situations that I mentioned. Life does not have to be prolonged when death is imminent. Passive euthanasia, refusing food and water, are permitted, as are other life-prolonging procedures. However, compassion for the dying person allows for administration of pain-relieving drugs, although they may cloud the mind. And there are many traditional Asian Buddhists who will refuse opiates and drugs because they want their minds to be absolutely clear at the point of death. The state of mind of the dying person is extremely important. Reflection on the good deeds done in one's life are important, as is the presence of family members and friends who remain positive and remind the person of that. Concern for the state of mind due to opiates use was not addressed in the research. However, in Chana's case, he could not maintain that state of mind and so preferred euthanasia, which I think is getting back to almost Senate Bill 128. So, there doesn't appear to be rigid guidelines, which is to be expected in this practice. There doesn't seem to be any rigid guidelines. The Buddha spoke individually to each situation. And so it's up to you to make the decision when the time comes for your loved ones, for yourself. But really think about it. That's Maranasati, accepting death, and how do you want your death to be? With a lot of conviction and a lot of wisdom and a lot of compassion for you and all other sentient beings. So I'm going to turn it over to Terry to tell us a little bit about Senate Bill 128.
The first thing I would like to clarify is that SB 128 is not euthanasia. Verbiage is so important in the process. Euthanasia is what Dr. Kevorkian did. It's when someone administers it to you. And in this case, I'm going to go over the details of it, but in this case, you have to be able to administer it to yourself. So I don't know, but that sounds more like the knife.
Mm-hmm. It I think you're right. And Terry and I talked about this, and I said there's no word I can use other than euthanasia because there's no other word except the knife. And that might be as close to it as I can get.
Well, anyway, that I think is an important distinction. I became interested and then involved in Death with Dignity, which in California is being called the End of Life Option Act, after the story of Brittany Menard put this issue back in the spotlight. Everybody began to start paying attention. I personally have two very close friends that I've known since junior high. One has a confirmed terminal diagnosis and lives in Louisiana. The other is fighting her third bout with serious cancer after having breast cancer, kidney cancer, and now they've discovered a large tumor in her stomach. And she will receive a diagnosis in the next few weeks. She lives in California. Neither of those states allow people to participate in the Death with Dignity Act. Currently, there are only 5 states that allow this. Oregon, which passed it in 1998, Washington in 2008, Montana in 2009, and Vermont and New Mexico, which passed it in 2014. It is a controversial issue. In 2014, Brittany Menard, a 29-year-old, was suffering from an incurable brain cancer, stage 4 glioblastoma. And the doctors told her that it could not be treated and that she would suffer with painful seizures and terrible headaches as her disease progressed. Because she lived in California, her choices were limited in terms of what she wanted to do. So she was forced to move to Oregon and establish residency to be able to take advantage of the Death with Dignity Act there that was passed 17 years ago. She left her home, her friends, and she was forced to create new relationships with new doctors. She lived her life for the next 6 months as best she could, and then on November 1st, with her family by her bedside, she died peacefully. January of this year, SB 128 was introduced by Senators William Monning, Lois Wolk, and Assemblymember Susan Eggman. And I'd like to just read a short bill summary so that you will know what this bill details. SB 128. SB 128 would establish the End of Life Option Act in California, modeled after Oregon's Death with Dignity Act that was enacted in 1997. This would allow a mentally competent, terminally ill adult in California in the final stages of his or her disease to request medication from a physician to bring about a peaceful death. Specifically, this bill will allow a terminally ill person 18 years of age or more, the right to obtain a prescription from his or her physician for medication to be self-administered. It requires 2 physicians to confirm the prognosis of 6 months or less, a written request, 2 oral requests to be made a minimum of 15 days apart, and 2 witnesses to attest to the request. The 2 physicians must also ensure that the person has the mental capacity to make healthcare decisions for himself or herself. SB 128 includes safeguards for physicians, pharmacists, and healthcare providers that follow the law to ensure that they will be immune from civil and criminal liability or professional disciplinary action when a patient exercises this option, which is one of the reasons why so many of the medical field have been resistant to this. In addition, participation for physicians, pharmacists, and healthcare providers in this law is voluntary, with the ability to opt out. Measures to protect vulnerable patients are also included in the legislation by establishing felony penalties for coercing someone to request the medication or for forging a request. The attending physician of the terminally ill patient who wishes to engage in the End of Life Option Act is required to discuss feasible alternatives and additional treatment opportunities, including but not limited to comfort care, hospice care, palliative care, and pain control. Finally, the patient can decide not to use the prescription and can rescind his or her request for the drug at any time. So the general principles underlying this bill are that we should always provide the highest quality end-of-life care to dying patients, including hospice and every other reasonable option. Two, it is important to remember that there are many ways to die with dignity, and no one way is the best way under all circumstances. And finally, what SB 128 attempts to address is that there is a difference between extending life and prolonging death, when the choice is not between life and death, but between one kind of death versus another. A recent poll taken regarding end-of-life requirements, terminal patients reported three main anxieties. One, the loss of all that makes life worthwhile. Two, the loss of dignity. And three, the possibility of unrelievable pain and suffering. And suffering is the number one greatest fear, even more than death. Critical data from 17 years in this act has been in effect in Oregon, and these are important factors. Only one in 25 people who request the medication qualify and receive it. In the last 17 years, 1,173 people have requested the medication. Only 752 have used the drugs. That's 64%. It's almost 35% did not use it. 95% were able to die peacefully at home and not in a hospital or a nursing home. 90% were enrolled in hospice. 95% had health insurance, which covered the service. And 42% were college educated. Best-selling books, such as Being Mortal by Atul Gawande, addresses the challenges that doctors and patients face in treating serious diseases and illnesses. Patients want to understand their options, and doctors must be more realistic with their patients about outcomes of various treatments. New national organizations, such as the Committee to Transform Advanced Care, which is being spearheaded by AARP, hospice, and many national hospitals, are looking at ways to deal with the large aging boomer population and the growing costs for their care, and are beginning to discuss more acceptable ways to handle serious illness and end-of-life issues. This bill has failed four times in California, the last time in 2007. But because of Brittany Menard and her story, the growing number of us baby boomers who want to take charge of being involved in decisions regarding their end-of-life issues, death with dignity is now being considered and introduced in 22 states. The safeguards in California's SB 128 are even more stringent than those governing Oregon's 17-year-old bill and law. And interestingly, during which time no cases of abuse have been documented or reported. This option is not for everyone, but it should not be withheld from those who qualify and want to exercise the right to have some control and choice at the end of life. It's that simple.
So we wanted to also, if anybody has any questions or comments or reflections or experiences that they've had, you know, in this regard with end of life issues or their own concerns. Yeah, Ginger.
Well, my mother had aplastic anemia, which is a serious blood disease where she was losing platelets. And she was on a breathing machine. And this was many years ago, and my uncle pulled the plug, so they must have allowed it because they put her back to life, she would have been brain dead, which was really horrifying to me. It was really... but anyhow, they died. They took her off of oxygen, you know, and
That's a little different situation than we're talking about here. In this situation with SB 128, you have to be able to make the decision yourself. Your mother was not of sound mind by the time she was on a machine. So that would not apply. My aunt has Alzheimer's, full-blown Alzheimer's. She could not take advantage of something like this if she were in the right state. You have to have the ability to make that decision.
So what I'm asking you is, you could die now, just like my mother did. Somebody else chose to have you put to sleep, or
no, they can't choose to put you to sleep.
Well,
I, not knowing all the details, it would be hard for me to comment. But it might have been something where her quality of life was so deteriorated that maybe he was appointed to make those decisions. Which, by the way, it's very, very important to make sure your advanced care directive is filled out and clear, if there's nothing else that everybody does here, and discuss it with your family.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest thing is for the family to see these kinds of things and not really be clear about what to do. And so sometimes out of mistaken hope, make decisions that are not really aligned with your wishes.
Yeah.
So, yes, Miles?
So this does not address situations where the patient is completely incapacitated, for example, is on what do you call it when you're intubated? What do they call that? And is unconscious, and the family can make the decision to so-called quote pull the plug. In other words, disconnect. You know, yes, they did that with my mother. It was 1997, and she had had a heart attack, so she was on, you know, she was being kept alive by, you know, in ICU, and we all gathered together children, and she had also left end-of-life wishes with her doctor, and they were well aware of that, and then we were there, and we seconded that decision, and then the nurse cleared it with the doctor, and they did something that surprised me. It actually pleased me, but They dosed her up heavily with morphine, not enough to cause death, but when they pulled everything out and they explained why they did that, she wouldn't be gasping, for example, for air. She would just quiet, which happened. She died within 5 to 10 minutes. She just faded out. And but I was surprised that they did that. And I have another question. I had read any number of times that medical professionals have caused death, directly caused death for people that were terminal, that were completely, you know, incapacitated, but it's just not, you know, it's never written down, it's not talked about, but they may just give a little bit, you know, a bit more morphine that's necessary, or some other drug, and bring them to death, and then it can be just chopped up. Well, you know, the patient was very sick and died.
I believe that probably happens a lot more than any of us might realize. When I was doing this research paper, they actually discussed that. And they said to consider why do you want this patient to die? Is it your own uncomfortableness, or is it really the patient is suffering? I think, which is a really good question, you know, to ask. It's thoughtful. And they gave an example where a doctor did exactly what you talked about, because he couldn't stand seeing this patient suffer.
My understanding is that they're in a patient is in a situation like that, there has to be agreement between the medical professionals and the family, and
that's right,
to do it. Because
it's advanced care directive.
There are cases where the family member simply disconnects or something, and that is, you know, tantamount to.
As Terry just said, advanced care directive, and it's so important to have that, and then also needing an advocate to make sure that takes place. When my husband died, they were about to resuscitate him. And I had to tell them no, because he said he did not want to live in that state any longer. I had to be there, and it was a very hard thing to do, to not bring, you know, your loved one back. But he did not want that. He made it clear. Yeah.
Just my final thing. I won't take up all the time. But my mother had that advance directive on file with the where she lived in this residence, and also at the hospital. But when she had the heart attack, they called 911, and of course paramedics come. Paramedics, I think, are obligated to resuscitate.
Yes.
Is my understanding. They cannot honor these directives. Would anyone know about that?
Yeah, that's true.
Which presented a dilemma, like in my mother's case.
Linnell had her hand up first.
Well, I just had a couple of comments. One, I was very struck by the piece about suffering being, end-of-life suffering being the number one concern of people. And I'm also struck by the fact that Buddhist practice deals with the concept of suffering and the concept of death. And it strikes me that people that have lived in denial about it ever happening, it's terrifying. It can be, you can imagine how terrifying it would be if you've never even really seriously entertained it. So the out of balanceness about the whole system, it strikes me that the advanced directives, hospice care, this are sort of going in the direction where people are starting the dialogue. The decision about how to do it seems still very unclear to me, because I think it's very, because it's so out of balance, people, I think, have a sort of second arrow response sometimes to things like that. And the other piece, that when you were talking about the pain and the opiates, sometimes I think physical pain is as destabilizing to the mind as any other kind of intoxicant.
Yeah.
So it's sort of hard to, you know, again, it's none of this stuff is very clear cut.
Exactly.
But I do think that our practice, and I mean, I know that's why you're doing what you're doing, is because you had that practice experience before you started to do the chaplaincy, because it gives us a broader view of the way, I mean, we're all suffering all the time,
mm-hmm.
but nobody wants to talk about it. I mean, if death is sort of the end of that piece, but anyway,
I just like to say one thing. I think that what this particular issue brings to people is not so much that they would do it,
right,
but that they would have the option should they decide to do it. Based on the statistics, you can see that there were a number,
right,
a percentage that did not want to do that. And you never know till you get there. But having control, having some element of control and choice at the end of life is what more of us care about, along with the impacted hospital system.
What Jerry was next?
Probably not. Probably 15 people were way ahead of me, but that's all right. But just practically speaking, so in this particular proposal for a law, is there an opportunity for a durable power of attorney for somebody who's either mentally aware or not mentally aware to begin that process?
No. Not that anyone could find out. You have to be able to administer the medicine yourself.
And I ask that question for a reason, because we are talking about kind of a range of issues here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, this particular thing is just one little piece of mm-hmm. our death and or our dying process and where we're all going, you know. And the durable power of attorney, the advanced directives, all of that comes into play with lots of different circumstances. Pulling the plug, having your loved ones pull the plug, having a doctor pull the plug, you know, all of that stuff is kind of a little bit aside from what this bill is.
Right.
This piece of law.
Right.
Yeah, and this really is for a situation where you have a terminal illness. More than it's not, many of us are going to die. Well, we're all going to die, but how we die I think what healthcare is looking at, the hospitals are so impacted, and it's only going to get worse. And medical care has not been on the side of the patient, and doctors have been taught to save lives at whatever cost, and not always to the benefit of the patient. So this is more for a situation where you're dealing with a terminal illness where you're suffering a lot, and it just gives you another choice. So it's certainly not going to fit a lot of people.
Next, back there.
You mentioned that this attempted law is going to give you the opportunity to terminate your life. I'm sorry, but I don't understand. I think I can terminate my life anytime, any day, whenever I want. So it sounds to me like this law will basically, what it tries to do is to remove the stigma of committing suicide and make it more acceptable by social.
Not exactly. Suicide is defined as you may not necessarily be near death. You may not be facing death. It comes from anguish. It comes from a lot of different places, ending your life. This is more specifically a legalized way for people with
terminal
illness. So it's different from what you're saying. Palliative care and hospice play into all of this, but those don't always serve people with some of their illnesses, and they would like to have a choice otherwise. So did that clarify that for you?
No. Because if I have a terminal illness, I don't need to go through a doctor. I don't need to go through the system. I don't need to go through an entire bureaucratic, excuse my language, crap, to terminate my life.
If you really know
especially
what you're doing.
If that law establish that I have to do it by myself. I don't need anyone to do that.
You're right, in some regards, but a lot of times people take medications and it doesn't kill them. A lot of times people do violent things to end their lives when they have no other options. So, yes, you're right, you can take your life anytime. In that regard, that's a totally different situation. This is for specific situations. This law fills a need for a situation other than I just want to go kill myself.
Okay, Ginger, you had a turn. How about you?
Well, I just want to say that I think that you're also correct that in addition, I mean, it seems like part of at least a side effect of the bill is the bill is to is to kind of legalize and you know remove the stigma. I mean, even if that's not the intended purpose, I think. I mean, I guess I'm just saying I agree with, I think I get what you're saying as well.
Okay.
And I can't remember my original question. Oh, I know. What can you talk about some of the main arguments that opponents have made, opponents of this bill in the past or currently?
Well, the main opponents to the bill are the Catholic Church. And
disability rights.
You can and the disability rights people, I think that people can be easily taken advantage of in that in that field. Catholic Church, of course, has to do with heaven and hell and purgatory and that type of thing. And the AMA is not on board yet, but there is a poll with independent doctors that show the majority of independent doctors, separate from this, do support this type of legislation. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons to come up with arguments. And most of them can be countered. I mean, this is just a personal decision and right that people in a situation like she's in, I mean, like my friend in Louisiana, she's in terrible pain. And she said, I looked at a bag over my head She said, I can't do that. She said, I looked at taking a heroin overdose, and she said, then I found out that you could probably throw that up and there'd be terrible consequences. She says, I don't have the guts to shoot myself. I mean, those are all horrible situations to really end your life. And there's no great way to end your life, but it would be nice to have it peaceful if you were going to take that tact.
Robin?
Yeah, I have two real quick points. When I first started hospice care many years ago, I really was concerned about karma. And the organization I worked with was Catholic. So there was also that situation that we had a certain opinion about life and supporting life and using the community resources of hospice and palliative care. But after I saw, I mean, I was a proponent of this. You live out your karma, and suffering might be part of it. After I saw some things and what real pain was, I never looked back. I just thought, who was I to ever think that? Who was I? Bone pain, bone cancer pain, the glioblastoma like this young woman had, terminal agitation, which is incredible. It's when we talk about dignity, no, these are not things human. I mean, it just doesn't seem human that we are put through. That's one point, although I still don't know any answer. I mean, I say that, but I know I don't know anymore. I know I'm not sure anymore. That's number one. Number two, there are many doctors, and this is what's unfortunate, because we put them in a legal position, yeah, and like a moral position. There are physicians out there that have arranged. Now, again, I work for a Catholic organization, and there was only a few nurses and I that would look across the room and nod our head when we realized that somebody had given whatever the cocktail is. Because it has to be the specific what Oregon is using, because sometimes you do not, the drugs do not, they present more of a problem later, and it can make more of a mental problem, you know, issues and recovery much more difficult from the terminal agitation and so forth. But there were times when family came all to town, and all of a sudden, you know, people had this nice dinner, and the next day, the patient just went to sleep. I mean, we got the call, the patient just had gone to sleep. So there was no doubt in my mind that these people had gotten some assistance from doctors. And this puts the doctors in a terrible dilemma, a moral dilemma, or making it feel that way, in a dirty dilemma, when... So I just want to offer that too. I think the doctors are out there, but they're afraid to say anything because of the oath and other problems with the AMA. And
but this bill particularly holds them
perfect.
You know,
yeah. That's the beauty of this bill.
And if a doctor still, even though they'll be held harmless, cannot do it, they can opt out. That does not behold every doctor to do that.
Well, I was just thinking about, I was reading in the paper, and I have along the way, about how the disabled community, disability rights community, opposes this. But I was just wondering, from what you said, Terry, wouldn't, and I worked at the regional center for a long time with people from profoundly retarded, as we used to say, to mildly. And then, of course, there's all the other kinds of disabilities where, you know, if someone has a physical disability, they may be able to make informed consent. But I don't see how anyone who is less than so-called normal intelligence would even be able to use this. In other words, I wonder if there's, you know, more concern on the part of the disability community than is warranted. Because at least if you look at, for example, my youngest son has schizophrenia. Well, he does very well in many respects, but would he really be able to really clearly consider the ramifications and make his own decision? Probably not. So even if I, which I never would, but if I were encouraging him to go ahead, I don't think this bill would allow such a thing anyway.
Is that true?
Well, and remember, you have to, this person has to be able to make the decision. I mean, they can't be, they have to be competent.
They have to be competent.
And they have to be within 6 months of death.
Right.
So there are safeguards in this.
Who gets to determine
so someone
competency?
Who, there was a question.
Well, I think the doctors do. As I understand, the doctors, you go to the doctor and they have to register it all. Excuse me, I've got a bad cough. I have to take this cough drop. But it is a doctor that makes that determination, along with the other factors I said. They have to see two doctors, not just one, two. And two witnesses have to support this person's request. So it's not just, I'm going to do this, and that's it. I mean, it out of the people, what were my statistics about? One out of 25 are the only ones that get it. There are a lot of people that go ask, but they don't qualify.
You had a comment or a question. Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't help but make the parallel when you were talking about the different things the Buddha had to say. He was very clear that in several cases, these four people were enlightened, knew what they were doing, take the knife. But it seemed to me when other people, excuse me, I have allergies, it seemed to me when other people were going to take that action for a person, he said no, because of the karma. The ancient Greeks had a word for that called miasma. If you were involved in someone's death, that was, you had to purify yourself. It seems to me this film does take, removes the physicians and the medical community from the possibility that you're a murderer. You know. I think that's very important because I know several doctors that have had tough decisions. My father-in-law and my mother died within 15 days of one another. My father-in-law and mother-in-law had called my ex about a year before and said, we want you to be the one to pull the plug. We've written it down. We don't trust your siblings. We think you will actually do it. Who am I married to? but
a little scary.
Yeah. And so she got a call and had to go up to, we were living in Atlanta, and she had to go up to Illinois. I stayed with my mother. The deal was I was to, when I got the call, go up there at the time of my father-in-law. Once we got through the wake and the funeral and all that, I went back to deal with my mother. The day I was supposed to take her out of a nursing home and to put her back into assisted living, I got a call that she was very sick. We put her in the hospital. Turned out she was severely septic. Didn't know much of what she was doing. I had tried for over a year to get her to deal with advanced directives. Doctor comes out and says to me, you have a decision to make. I wasn't prepared for this. Right. And, he explained, if they took extreme measures, what her life would likely be like. And they said, I signed the papers. To this day, I'm not sure I did the right thing. But, and then third case, my step-uncle lived in Minneapolis, and he took a dive off one of the bridges there into the Mississippi River and killed himself. He was not ill, aside from being an alcoholic. I don't know what was wrong with his life, really. But I think that's a third dimension. You can take your life any time. He did die from that jump, but some people don't.
Right. Well, this, I think, as Terry has made clear, is really, really specific. Mm-hmm. Terminally ill people with 6 months or less to live and having the option. And I listened to NPR when they had a debate between, you know, the advocates and the people
dissenters.
Yeah. And I think a really good point was made that a lot of people got a whole lot of peace of mind knowing it was available. Even if they weren't going to take advantage of it, knowing if things just got really, really bad, there was something to alleviate suffering.
I heard that same interview, and I think that data from Oregon, the majority of people who took that option were cancer patients.
Yeah.
Yes, they were. A large majority of them.
Yeah. You know what? It is 9 o'clock, and you know what that means. It means you're all going home now. So thank you all for coming. Let's just do a very quick metta. So may you all be safe and protected from all types of harm and danger. May you all be peaceful and happy and healthy and strong. May you be at ease with your life. No matter how it's unfolding, may you have ease. And may every single one of you here, may you be liberated in this lifetime. And may all beings be free. Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you.